This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The quote from Bertrand Russell, 1949. At present, all except the most thoughtless live under the shadow of fear. I welcome the historian Nick Bunker. His new book, In the Shadow of Fear, America and the World in 1950. These are the months between Labor Day 1949 and the North Korean sneak attack on South Korea in late June of 1950, in which everything changed for my life, for the life of the 20th century in America, and perhaps for the world, although there's unfinished business here, because what I learned from Nick is that everything was in place in that period that we struggle with today in Asia, in Europe, questions about budget, questions about personality, the presidency, all of that. I welcome Nick. Nick, it's a great pleasure to speak with you again. We've had occasion to talk about your Young Benjamin Franklin, which is inspirational, and your Empire on the at the Edge, which is the story of right before the revolution in the 18th century. Here we are now in the 20th century. We're getting closer to modern times, Nick. And we're dealing with personalities that are well known if you've read this period, but not if you're just watching the news reports in the 21st century. I want to begin with the president of the United States, Harry Truman. He inherits the office at the death of Franklin Roosevelt in early 1945. He's aged considerably now as we meet him in the Labor Day in 1949. What do we need to know about Harry Truman and his desire to be a good president, even to run for re-election, because he's eligible to run again, a surprise victory in 48? At that moment, what are his thoughts about his responsibility as president? Good evening to you, Nick.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be with you, too. Harry Truman, my book opens in September 1949. And at that point, Harry Truman was a man in his 60s, early 60s. He had, as you said, been re-elected or elected president in his own right in November 1948, a stunning victory against, with a lot of skeptics arguing that he was going to be defeated by his opponent, the Republican Tom Dewey. But nevertheless, Truman had won this extraordinary victory. The trouble was that a year on, in 1949, things had not gone well for Harry Truman. First problem he had was that there had been an economic recession. Almost as soon as the ballots were counted in November 1948, that recession began, and it dragged on throughout the first half of 1949 and a little way into the fall. And that had really been a big problem for Harry Truman, because Harry Truman had come back into office in 1949 as president, determined to implement a very bold package of liberal reforms called the Fair Deal, which were intended to extend and develop Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They were intended to go further along the same kind of path. And the trouble was that the recession of 1949 blew a hole in his budget. It meant that the federal budget had a deficit of $5 billion, which in modern terms sounds like very little, but actually it was 2% of the size of the American economy at the time. And he'd also run into all sorts of difficulties with his own party. There was dissension within the Democratic Party, which was preventing him from implementing his liberal policies. And, of course, he had to cope with the great problems of the Cold War, what was already known as the Cold War. And in particular, one particular issue in 1949, which was the communist takeover of China. communist, the People's Republic of China was proclaimed by Mao Zedong in Beijing in October 1949. And that was very much the backdrop for everything that was occurring at this point. So Truman, having come back into office in that January in an optimistic and a buoyant mood, had then found himself kind of overtaken by events. And that's really very much the kind of the theme of my book, this being overtaken by events.
Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, a man who was educated to be a member of the elite class of jurists, Groton School, Yale College, Harvard Law School, Felix Frankfurter, his mentor, clerking at the court. He takes the role of Secretary of State after George Marshall retires for health reasons. Dean Acheson is the son of the Bishop of Connecticut and an heiress of a liquor fortune in Canada. He's extremely well-educated, extremely well-dressed. He is a strange character, however, wandering into a room with Harry Truman. How do they get on?
Well, they got on extremely well. They had a lot of things in common, in particular their kind of political philosophy. Now, you mentioned the fact that Acheson had trained as a lawyer and he'd been the protege of Felix Frankfurter, the famous Supreme Court justice. But what Acheson had also done is he had clerked at the Supreme Court himself in the 1920s under another Supreme Court justice, Louis Brandeis, who was also a kind of a mentor for Truman. And both of them, all three of them, in fact, Brandeis, Wilson, and Acheson, were great admirers of Woodrow Wilson. And they were great admirers of Woodrow Wilson's kind of liberal internationalist philosophy. Truman, for example, of course, greatly supported entry into World War I in 1917. And so they were united by that kind of a bond, their respect for the kind of the Wilsonian legacy. And also, of course, Acheson was very, very competent. He was a very competent, diligent official who was very good indeed at getting to the heart of a problem and getting policies into practice. He was very good indeed at getting policies into practice. It's one thing to have policies, another thing to actually get them executed. And he was very good at that. And so there was a bond of kind of loyalty and respect and personal affection between Truman that was really very important.
One more player before we turn to the communist side. Lewis Johnson is Secretary of Defense. He has ambitions to be President of the United States. He and Acheson will clash over these 10 months and beyond. What do we need to know about Lewis Johnson and what he thought his role was at defense as they were still de-escalating the World War?
Lewis Johnson was a very important character at the time. I mean, his reputation historically is very poor because he had to resign during the early days of the Korean War when it was revealed the extent of military unpreparedness of the United States. But he had indeed had aspirations to be president. He went back a long way. He was a Democrat. He had been an ardent supporter of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Johnson had also had quite an important role in the run-up to World War II because he had been a defense official at the Pentagon prior to Pearl Harbor. And Johnson could claim credit for various things. For example, he was the man who pushed hardest for the production of the B-17 Flying Fortress bomber. So he had a pretty good reputation. But he did have these ambitions to be president. And also, he wanted to really leave his mark on things. Now, when he became Secretary of Defense in 1949, as you say, America was still in the process of, to some extent, actually reducing its military expenditure. It was reducing the military establishment that it had during World War II. And Lewis Johnson went at this task of cutting costs and reducing expenditure with a great deal of enthusiasm. Partly he did that because I think he wanted to appeal to the fiscally conservative wing of the Democratic Party. There was a very strong fiscally conservative wing of the Democratic Party, particularly emanating from the South. And if Johnson was going to achieve what he wanted, which was to be nominated for president in 1952, then he was going to need their support. The difficulty was he went too far. He went too far. He depleted America's military readiness. And also he engaged in personal feuds, particularly with Dean Acheson. And these kind of led to his downfall.
He enjoyed those feuds. Now we go to the Democratic Party that dominates the conversation in Congress, has for many decades since the catastrophe of the recession, depression in the late 20s. The Democratic Party in 1949 is dominated by what was at once the Confederacy. Two names come back again and again. One is Sam Rayburn from Texas. The other is Walter George from Georgia. How was that relationship with the president, Harry Truman, in 49?
Well, not a very easy one, actually. In fact, Walter George, whom you mentioned, actually was much closer eventually to Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president. He and Walter George were very close indeed later on when George was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Now, in 1949, George was a man in his 70s. He'd been senator for Georgia since 1922. And, of course, he was totally unassailable because at that time, Georgia was absolutely rock-solid Democrat. So Democrat, in fact, the Republicans often didn't even field candidates because they couldn't find anybody foolhardy enough to run against a Democrat. Now, Walter George is important because he was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and he was one of the fiscal conservatives that Harry Truman had so much trouble with. Walter George was very worried about the federal budget deficit. Now, the budget deficit then wasn't actually huge. It's only $5 billion. That was only about, as I say, 2% of America's gross domestic products. Less than half of the kind of levels of fiscal deficit you have today in 2024. But nevertheless, he was very worried about it. And he was a skeptic about many of Harry Truman's policies. He was anti-labor union. He didn't really want to see what Harry Truman wanted to see, for example, which was a universal health insurance scheme. He didn't really want to see any more public spending on anything, except unless it would directly benefit his constituents in the South. And he was a skeptic about NATO. And one of the big issues of 1949 was that the NATO treaty had been signed, but NATO needed to be turned from being just a lot of ink on paper into being a genuine armed Western alliance against the Soviet Union. And Walter George, like many congressmen at the time, congressmen and senators, actually was quite skeptical about whether NATO was feasible and whether it would become a kind of drain on America's resources.
And Sam Rayburn, was he a player at first about this challenge of NATO and the fair deal?
Rayburn was much more of a loyalist to Truman. I mean, Sam Rayburn, coming from Texas, obviously was very powerful because the Texas contingent to Congress, which grew up by Lyndon Johnson, of course, was enormously powerful. He tended to be more, much closer to Truman, much more of a loyalist. But even he was a conservative, and he tended to try and put a brake on some of the programs that Harry Truman wanted to institute. There was a particular issue, obviously, about segregation.
Yes.
Now, Harry Truman had returned to the White House in 1949, determined to implement civil rights legislation, which would have been the first federal civil rights legislation since the 1870s, since the end of the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And Rayburn and his colleagues effectively put a complete brake on this. So Rayburn wasn't really prepared to go along with this at all. And that became a big issue inside the Democratic Party, which caused all kinds of splits and dissensions. And it was one of the things that the issue of civil rights, which undermined the coherence and stability of the Democratic Party at a time when, during the Cold War, they really needed to be fully united around the president.
I'm speaking with Nick Bunker. His new book is In the Shadow of Fear, America and the World in 1950. We're going to Moscow. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.